I'm Marty Moscoane. Welcome to Radio Times. If you are an undocumented immigrant, your chances of being deported have increased under memoranda released earlier this week by the Department of Homeland Security. While the Obama administration focused in the last few years on gang members, felons, and people who posed a threat to national security, the Trump administration has widened the net of those who can be deported. It calls for more detention facilities, more border guards and immigration officials, speeded up deportations, training law enforcement to work with Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE, to identify undocumented immigrants. The Dreamers, those brought here as children, are not included in these orders. This Trump campaign promise has made immigrant communities very worried. We wanted to hear about immigrant communities here in Philadelphia, which is a sanctuary city, how they are feeling about the Trump administration's crackdown. We have three guests who have joined us here in our Philadelphia studio. Caitlin Barry, assistant professor of law at Villanova University School of Law, where she also directs the Farmworker Legal Aid Clinic. And Caitlin Barry, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty.
You're welcome. Also with us is Erica Almiron, and she's executive director of Juntos. That's a South Philadelphia community-led organization, the daughter of immigrants. And Erica Almiron, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. And rounding out our trio of guests is Erica Guadalupe Nunez. She's an artist, a printmaker, community organizer, came to the U.S. when she was 10 years old. And Erica Guadalupe Nunez, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you.
I'm doing first and last names because we have two shared first names. Let me begin with you, if I can, Erica Almiron, which is help us understand in the last couple of days what kind of calls, questions, comments that you have gotten at Juntos.
So I think that over actually the last couple of months, we have received an uptick of activity in the office since the election, actually. And I think part of it has been that we have seen some changes, changing behaviors by local police who have felt emboldened by, I think, the Trump administration rolling in and feeling like they were protected. And so we've had a lot of conversations in the community about police and racial profiling. And then we've also done a lot of Know Your Rights sessions, deportation defense, organizing strategies, talked about our sanctuary city policies and what other policies we need to do in this time. So even last week, we had 40 chairs in our office, and we had a room of 130 people coming in for a deportation defense.
So Know Your Rights training. People are worried?
People are worried, and people are preparing, and people are being, I think, powerful in this moment.
Let me turn to you, Caitlin Barry, and I have a number of legal questions, and I know some of them we can't answer because we don't really know yet how this will all be carried out. But does someone who is here undocumented, an undocumented immigrant, do they have legal rights? Let's say ICE knocks on their door or ICE pulls them over as they're walking the sidewalk or driving their car. Do they have legal protections?
Absolutely. Every person residing in the United States has the right to due process, including people who are undocumented. And so in the context of an ICE stop or an ICE arrest, it is crucial that people are observing and recording what is taking place to be able to challenge any racial profiling, any abuse that happens during the arrest. People have the right to remain silent. They have the right to refuse to sign any forms and the right to challenge their case.
And the right to a lawyer?
They have the right to a lawyer, but at their own expense. They will not be provided with an attorney. So as you can imagine, that is a big barrier to individuals and families who are low income, who can't afford attorney's fees.
We're talking in a sanctuary city. Are the laws any different in this city? I mean, I know they are sort of broadly speaking, but as it pertains to individuals, and Erica Almiron was talking about the police turning up the pressure on some people who are here undocumented. Does that make a difference if we're in a sanctuary city?
So in a sanctuary, sanctuary, as you can imagine, is a very broad term. It can mean a lot of different things. And I think it's very important that we are as specific and as clear as possible about what kind of policy we actually have. You've had Mayor Jim Kenney on your show many times, and he has labeled our policy a Fourth Amendment policy. Is what the city's policy does is it recognizes the constitutional rights of all citizens, of all residents, excuse me, including people who are not U.S. citizens. And to be free from warrantless arrests and detention. That is all that it does. And I think it's and a really important conversation that we're having right now. And I think Juntos is one of the leaders in this conversation about really trying to understand what could sanctuary mean for the residents of Philadelphia. What would real safety and real protection look like? We're not there yet. We have a lot of really fantastic leaders and resources available to our community members, but we need more if we're going to be offering real protection and real opportunities to defend each other.
We could do a whole hour on this. Mm-hmm. President Obama was called the deporter in chief. Mm-hmm. He deported more than 2 million people. It seems in the last couple of years, the focus was really on gangs and people who posed a direct threat to communities. How dramatically different, I'll put this to you, Erica Almiron, and I'm going to get our other Erica in on the conversation as well, but how dramatically different are these directives under President Trump? Can you tell? Is it too early?
It's too early to see what it's going to look like on the ground. I think what we're seeing is a lot of emotion in communities about what the memos have said and what that makes people feel like. But I think it's also important to recognize that under the Obama administration, 2 million people got deported, right? Criminal convictions, non-criminal convictions, people who were considered collateral, who were picked up in raids. So raids have happened in the Obama administration. Raids are happening in the Trump administration. We have not seen an uptick in Philadelphia just yet in raids, but they have continued to happen. I think this rhetoric of criminal and non-criminal is actually super divisive, because if we talk about how policing and the criminal system targets black and brown communities, we could have a whole discussion of who is sitting inside of our detention centers, our jails, who's being deported, and how they're making a profit off of keeping our bodies locked up.
That's an issue for another discussion, but I appreciate you making that point. Let me do one more question to you, Caitlin Barry. I noticed in these memos the use of the word alien. I don't know if that's incendiary language, whether that's legalese when describing people who are here undocumented.
I don't know if there's always a distinction between incendiary language and legalese. The word alien has been commonly used in immigration laws for a long time. It's not unusual that they would use that word, but that doesn't mean that it's also not disrespectful and inflammatory. And I just wanted to echo Erica's point about being very careful about the language that we use. When we are labeling people as threats to our community, I think we have to be asking threats to whom? Mm-hmm. Whose safety are we respecting? Whose voices are being allowed to participate in the conversation about what safety and security means? And I think it's crucial that each of us takes that responsibility very seriously as we're engaging in these conversations. Because as we're seeing, these orders are... they're an attack on our communities. They're an unapologetic and systematic attempt to destroy our communities.
Because everyone is deportable, as I read them.
Well, as a person who is not at direct threat of deportation, this is going to destroy my community as well. It's going to destroy my ability to build relationships with my neighbors, for my neighbors to be able to feel safe in their community. And I'm a member of that community as well. This is an attack on our values as a city. And I think we need to be very clear about that and very conscious of how we are participating in validating these sort of ideas about immigrants presenting threats to our community.
Let me get you in on the conversation, Erica Guadalupe Nunez. You're an artist. You live here in Philadelphia. You came with your mom from Mexico. You were, what, 10 years old?
Yeah, I was 10 years old.
What brought your mom, or why did she want to come to the United States?
So I guess I can start with saying that when we talk about immigration, lots of times we don't consider why our people migrate, why they have to leave their home country. It's not a choice that we make willingly. Often there's outside forces that force us to leave our homes. In the case of me and my mother, we wanted to return with our family. We're a mixed status family. My mother and I at the time were undocumented. My father was a long permanent resident, and he was living in the U.S. with my brother. And so we were returning back with my two sisters who were citizens. And it was sort of like the idea that my mother knew that I would have a better life in the U.S. And that was just because of the economic state in Mexico. And that was a choice that she made. And it was hard for her, I know, that to have to consider crossing the desert with her 10-year-old daughter and what would happen. But for us, it was just a matter of surviving. months.
How did you survive? I mean, how many miles did you have to walk? What was it like to?
It took probably 3 days in total for us to cross. It's something I still have nightmares about.
Do you?
Yeah, and I'll wake up. It's odd. I'll wake up in the middle of the night and I'm like, God damn it, not again, you know. But that's not something that's just unique to me. I think it's common across immigrant communities in the U.S., whether you're coming from Mexico or Central America or other countries such as Asia, for example. And again, migration is not often, it's a violent thing that we have to go through. And often the reasons why we migrate are, and this is could be a conversation for another day, but are often caused by imperialistic policies from other countries, especially Western countries.
So. Well, we certainly know Central America has that history that, you know, is complicated and probably explains some of what we're talking about today. I don't want to make you relive some of these nightmares, but was it just the danger of being with your mom in unforgiving landscapes, environments? Were there people that were threatening you as well?
There were probably some sketchy people we met ahead of time. There were some other ways that we wanted to get across the border that I didn't want to do because I didn't think it was safe, and that she didn't. We were mostly by ourselves, actually. My mom is a luchadora. She's a fighter. One thing that she would tell me all the time is, don't let anyone see you be afraid. And that's something I carry with me to this day. Absolutely.
So looked strong, looked tough.
Mm-hmm.
You ended up in Philadelphia.
I did.
Is that where you
No, actually, I lived in Phoenix, and then I moved to the Midwest, and then I eventually landed here in Philadelphia after college. So.
Are you considered a dreamer, or were you considered a dreamer?
I personally don't like to identify with that term. I think that term, like we mentioned earlier, is a divisive term. It kind of parrots the model minority rhetoric, which is violent in our community, when you say these people are more valuable to our society than others, it makes that other group of people more deportable. And that's not a kind of rhetoric that I'd like to engage in. I definitely think that now I'm not considered a dreamer. I have a criminal record that is easy to pull up with my history doing civil disobedience actions. And yeah, I personally don't identify as a dreamer. Others might say that with me, but I think that's what they're choosing to see and the label they're choosing to apply to me.
Again, yeah.
Because again, they see me as they don't see me as a criminal, you know, but I am. And it's just, they're letting themselves pick and choose who they see as valuable and worthy. Mm-hmm. So.
Now you have a green card.
Yes.
In the last couple of days or since the inauguration of Donald
Trump? I actually
Trump?
Got it when I was 20 years old.
Okay.
I received it through a U visa, which is a separate program from DACA.
And we're almost up on a break here, but what's your reaction to what the president has done?
Well, I have mentioned this to my friends and my family that I'm not surprised by what he's doing. This is exactly what he's saying on the what he said he'd do on the campaign trail, which is why it blows my mind when I meet someone and say, wow, I can't believe he's doing this. And I'm like, wasn't one of his chants build the wall? Isn't that something he said all the time? So for me, I'm unsurprised. It still doesn't make the impact of his words and his actions any less strong. My mother, for example, she is now a permanent resident, but my stepfather is undocumented. So we're terrified about what might happen to him.
Let's take a very short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. That's Erica Guadalupe Nunez. She's an artist, community organizer here in Philadelphia. Erica Almiron is executive director of Juntos, and also with us, Caitlin Berry, assistant professor of law at Villanova University School of Law. Much more after this short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moskowain talking with my three guests about their reactions and the reaction of the immigrant communities here in Philadelphia, which happens to be a sanctuary city, how they are feeling about the Trump administration's crackdown on people who are in the United States undocumented. And you can join our conversation by texting us or making a phone call to 267-405-2006. We will play those comments on the air. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Let me read an email from Richard who says the scapegoating, he's saying here, of illegal immigrants that Mr. Trump relishes and which the Republican Party finds so becoming is racist and ethnically divisive. There is no illegal immigrant crime wave in this country or even porous border. Let me talk a bit about the association with crime. And part of the memorandum talked about undocumented immigrants, quote unquote, routinely victimizing Americans. And perhaps, Caitlin Berry, I can go with you, because everything I have read is that when you compare the crime rate of people who are here undocumented to native born Americans are much more likely to engage in crime than people who are not.
That's right, Marty. And I also don't know that that's a very useful road to go down. I don't know that, again, we want to be hinging someone's right to remain in their community on their history with the criminal system. We live in a city that is trying very hard to respect the rights of returning citizens, of people who are formerly incarcerated. We've seen campaigns like the Ban the Box campaign, which is attempting to eliminate employment discrimination against people who are formerly incarcerated. We are very clear on the fact that people need resources to be able to turn their lives around. And when we go down this path of arguing that immigrants are or that only innocent immigrants should be deserving of remaining in their communities, or starting to look at all of these statistics about do people commit crimes or not, we're getting away from the bigger question, right, which is that it is a human right to migrate, and it's a human right to be able to remain in your community with your family. It should not be dependent on someone's prior contact with the criminal system.
Even if they're violent? Even if it's a violent crime? Is that a disqualifier?
I think we need to take a look at what the root causes are of violence and move away from this reactive mode of every time that there is an individual crisis, trying to create a bunch of policies to respond to that crisis rather than looking at the bigger picture. What are we actually doing to prevent violence in our communities? It's been shown time and time again that investing in jobs, education, and healthcare is the best way to prevent violence, to prevent people from making choices like this. So why is that the conversation that we're not having? Why are we so focused on stripping rights away from people as they are coming out of prison? Why are we so focused on creating this secondary level of punishment for people who are not U.S. citizens instead of thinking about how are we actually, again, returning the question of sanctuary, creating real safety and real trust in our communities?
Let me go back to you, Erica Almiron, and even from your work at Juntos, and you mentioned the fact that you're getting lots of phone calls, lots of questions. What specific advice do you give to someone who is in fear of deportation?
We tell folks that their power sits in themselves, and that, one, they need to know their rights, and then, two, they need to get organized. And so the first piece is what to do. The biggest barrier to being deported right now is knowing your rights when ICE comes to your door, if they pull you over, if they come into your job, and creating an understanding of not opening the door. Most of the times they don't have warrants. Most of the time they do not have warrants signed by a judge. They are very tricky when they try to get into somebody's house. They'll show pictures. They'll incessantly knock. It's almost torturous the way they try to get into people's homes. And then we also teach them what to do if they do get picked up. What is your emergency plan? Who's going to pick up your child from school? Just getting everything lined up. And we tell them to talk to a lawyer, but, you know, I think that some of the rhetoric that we're hearing is that if we could just get everybody lawyers, that we would save them. And that actually isn't true. What we need to be attacking is the fact that you have somebody like Trump putting out memos like this and attacking the system rather than trying to lawyer everybody up in this moment, because people get ripped off. I have people who owe thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars.
To shady lawyers?
A lot, yes. A lot of money is being – how much is a bond? I have families who have sold everything to try to get to stay in the country, and it's ripping off already vulnerable and poor communities. It's a shame.
Erica Guadalupe Nunez, let me turn to you, and you were telling us a little bit about your life and your family. And I don't know if you like this word. It's been often described as mixed status, in that you have documented parents. You have a step parent who is undocumented. I'm sure their families like yours, where some people are born in this country, so they would be American citizens. When there are stepped up deportation or plans for deportation, what is the effect on a family like yours?
I think when people think about deportation, they think about how it only affects the one person, when in reality it not only affects their family, but also a whole community. So thinking immediately having Trump become president, I thought of my family at home. I thought about my stepfather, who is the love of my mom's life, is how I describe him. And I just think, to me, how she would feel if he was deported. She would be completely distraught. And that's not including the fact that he also supports his own family in Mexico. So people think about deportation just having a single effect, but it actually causes a ripple in the community. It would change my mom's life drastically. It would change my sister's life drastically. It would change his family back home. And also just the friends and family that he's built, the community that he's built here in Phoenix, Arizona, would also be affected by his absence.
Does that mean people like your stepfather go underground? Is that one of the things that people do?
Some people do go underground. My stepfather isn't choosing to. He doesn't like the idea of hiding away. Yeah.
You're nodding your head.
Yeah, I think we have people who we have conversations with people, right? And so I think that it's something that's a choice if people want to stay more hidden or if they want to come out. We spent a long time telling people to come out of the shadows and to not be afraid and that their strength in his numbers, and I fully believe that. I actually think that the more organized we are, the stronger we are. But I also don't judge anybody who is in this moment saying, I'm not comfortable with that. And I said, that's fine. If you're not comfortable with it just yet, that's fine.
I read, I think it comes from Pew, that there's something like 50,000 undocumented immigrants in Philadelphia. Just to sort of put all of this into some kind of context, you're saying yes?
Yeah, that sounds about right. Juntos is in South Philadelphia. And I think there's this assumption that most undocumented people are Mexicanos or Mexican. But we also know that there are lots of Irish undocumented folks in Northeast Philadelphia, Eastern European and Russian undocumented folks here, and Asian, Korean, Central American. Migration comes from all over the world. And the ability to get in line is a lie. There is no line. Right. The line is actually and it's almost impossible for so many people. So that's why you have 50,000 people in the city like Philadelphia.
Let me just read a comment that picks up Erica Almaron and what you just said. And I'll put this to you, Caitlin Barry, an email from Sandra. How hard is it to get documented? Which, again, is a discussion for a whole separate hour. But just in the context of what we're talking about.
I mean, we've seen really since 1996 a dramatic restriction on the opportunities to obtain legal status in the United States, particularly for people who cross the southern border. It is wildly difficult and in most cases impossible to obtain legal status here in the United States. Eric is absolutely right. I mean, if people had the opportunity to go in and obtain a work permit, everyone that I work with would jump at that opportunity. And it's just not there. There just are no options. And people, you know, as they're organizing, as they're becoming more empowered and educated about the system, are learning how small the opportunity really is. And I just wanted to return to the point that Erica made about coming out and building power in communities, which I think is so crucial. This morning I was on the phone with a woman that I work with who lives out in Avondale, Pennsylvania, where she picks mushrooms. She's the sole supporter of her four children. Her husband was murdered before they came to the United States. And she hasn't been able to go to work for a week. She doesn't want to send her kids to school because she is so terrified that they are going to raid her workplace and raid her children's school and force them to return to the country where her husband was murdered. And my first thought was, I wish there was a place like Juntos, like New Sanctuary Movement, a community center where she could go, where she would not feel so alone.
I mean, literally go and be?
Absolutely, where she could find community and find support, because I think that there is so much power that can be built there. As many times as I can tell her, you know, in your particular situation, you don't actually have anything to fear under these new memos. You know, the situation that you're in, it has not changed. Mm-hmm. It's not the same when it comes from me. If people can hear it from someone who has been through it and who understands what it's like.
That's Caitlin Barry, assistant professor of law at Villanova University School of Law, directs the Farmworker Legal Aid Clinic. Also with us, Erica Almaron, and she's executive director of Juntos, a South Philadelphia community-led organization, the daughter of immigrants. Also with us, Erica Guadalupe Nunez. She's a printmaker and artist, community organizer, and lives here in Philadelphia as well, telling us a little bit about how she came to the States. And you can join our conversation by calling our comment line or send us a text, 267-405-2006. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Let me read a text from Jake. I'm a carpenter. A lot of my coworkers aren't U.S. citizens. They are my friends, and I don't want them to get deported. Can your guest tell me what I can do as a U.S. citizen to keep this from happening?
Great question.
Yeah, I'll throw it to all of you, but let me start with you, Erica Almiron.
I mean, I think if he, first off, what a great question. And I think also there are things that he could do, that he could go on the Juntos website. We have information there about what he can teach a lot of those coworkers about what to do if ICE comes, and start preparing them and doing some of the work to make sure that he stands with them. And we also tell anybody who's an ally, like this carpenter, they could also reach out to Juntos and volunteer. And we have a lot of volunteer opportunities, and bring them to Juntos. We could also train them.
Does it make sense to call your congressperson? Does that matter?
Sure. There's Tuesdays with Toomey if people want to go to Toomey's office. I think he just moved his building to a federal building to get more security, so it's working.
Erica Guadalupe Nunez, you want to respond to our carpenter?
I would definitely think that he should go to the Juntos website and definitely consider how he can be an ally in the workplace, considering that there might be an uptake in raid. If he is ever in a situation where he's near a raid or can witness a raid, what he can do. And like Caitlin mentioned earlier, recording a raid, documenting what is happening, making sure that his coworkers know their rights if they are ever taken away, is a huge step that he could do.
Right. So, for example, there was a situation in Palmerton, Pennsylvania, where police partnered with immigration agents to go into a pizza shop. They were there to arrest two individuals. But while they were there, immigration agents questioned other employees and then subsequently detained them. And so just thinking about the question from this person about what you can do in that situation, any U.S. citizen employees could have been asking questions, could have been recording, could have been documenting information, and then immediately trying to reach out and find assistance for the people who were picked up.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you, I'm going to put this to you, Caitlin Berry, because as we know, numbers of parts of our economy, agriculture, I think the restaurant business, landscaping relies not entirely, but in many ways on undocumented immigrants, on immigrants, but also undocumented immigrants as well. And I've always thought it was sort of a kind of a wink, wink, nudge, nudge policy that we have about immigration, in that we threaten to deport people, and yet we rely on these people to pick our crops.
Absolutely.
Clean our hotel rooms or motel rooms.
Absolutely. And Pennsylvania is a very agricultural state. We represent people on dairy farms, on who pick tomatoes, who pick lettuce, who pick mushrooms. Pennsylvania produces 50% of the mushrooms sold in the United States, who pick apples, who pick peaches, and people all over the state of Pennsylvania. And those industries are going to be very significantly impacted by these policies, absolutely.
And I'm sure, Erica Almiron, you've heard the argument, which is that illegal or undocumented immigrants take away jobs from American-born workers, and they don't contribute to our economy. Can you speak to that?
Well, I'll start by saying that I think our communities are more than their labor, right? And I think that the conversation becomes that our value is situated in what kind of jobs we do. And my mom is a domestic worker, has always been since she came here. And she's more than a domestic worker. She's my mother. She goes to church. She's a loved person in the community. So, and I'm very proud of her for all of the work that she's done, even with her advanced arthritis right now, because of all the work that she's done her whole life. So I think that the contributions that people have made go beyond their components of labor. But I think it's also that if there are not enough jobs in this country, it has more to do with that we have a system of billionaires and millionaires who are essentially taking up all of these resources, and we're not having conversations about true creations of jobs. And so I think that that's the conversation, is like, what are we doing to actually ensure that people have a way to produce income for all of our families, rather than say, pick communities against each other who are already struggling.
Erica Guadalupe Nunez, you want to weigh in on that at all?
I mean, I completely agree with what everything that Erica Almiron and Caitlin Berry have said. When you get upset about an immigrant stealing your job, saying that, you should actually be thinking about the people offering that jobs and why they're only offering it at that rate of pay, or with only this, like, that type of job in general. You shouldn't be upset at the person who's out of their own need taking that job. That to me is not, that's not how it's going to be fixed. So
yeah. You're nodding your head there, Caitlin.
Absolutely. I mean, it, just what Eric was saying about the fact that we have an economy that has created these jobs that pay so little for work that literally physically destroys your body. I think we need to think really seriously about that and why these are the types of crumbs that they're forcing people to compete over instead of joining together to build their power and demand better working conditions for everyone. Mm-hmm. And campaigns like the Fight for 15 that are demanding an actual living wage, right?
A tweet from Steve, residing here doesn't make you a citizen. An email from Deb, would you please define explicitly what undocumented means? There's a lot of language here, language questions. Mm-hmm. Can I toss that to you, Erica Almiron?
What does undocumented
what
mean?
What does that mean?
It's a term that's used inside of our community. I think for a very long time we've heard the words aliens, we've heard the word illegal, and we reject any of those terms that talk about a whole community as less than. Undocumented just means that you don't have the documentation to live in this country. You know, so whether that be citizenship, a social security card, you know, things of that nature.
You want to add to that?
Right. I think it's important for people, especially in Pennsylvania, to understand people who do not have proof of legal status here in the United States can't obtain driver's licenses. Mm-hmm. They are not eligible and do not receive public benefits. Mm-hmm. They can't obtain a social security number. They can't really obtain any sort of state identification. And as you can imagine, the barriers that that prevents to people being able to survive are very real. And was the first question, doesn't living here make you a U.S. citizen?
Residing here doesn't make you a citizen. I'm just reading comments here. Sure. That was a tweet from Steve. We'll let that
Unfortunately not, no. Just residing in the United States does not give you a citizenship.
Fair enough. Let's take a very short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. And we've got a fourth guest who will be joining us, talking with Caitlin Berry, Assistant Professor of Law at Villanova University School of Law, Director of the Farm Worker Legal Aid Clinic, Erica Almiron, Executive Director of Juntos in South Philadelphia, and artist Erica Guadalupe Nunez. And again, you can join our conversation by calling us or texting us at 267-405-2006. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Steve Camerata waiting in the rings, waiting in the wings from the Center for Immigration Studies. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. We've been talking about the Trump administration's plans for stricter immigration enforcement, particularly its effect on immigrant communities here in Philadelphia. And joining us now is Stephen Camerata, Director of Research at the Center for Immigration Studies. And Stephen Camerata, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Well, thanks for having me.
Do you support what the president and the Department of Homeland Security is doing?
Yeah, essentially what the memos say is that the immigration law is back in business. There's a great small quotation from one of the memos. It says, look, the department no longer will exempt classes or categories of removable aliens from potential enforcement. In other words, if you're here illegally, you can be sent home. And I think the vast majority of people in the United States basically agree with that assumption. I mean, everyone kind of agrees that we've massively neglected immigration enforcement. Just to give you one statistic, but there are many, we have 900,000 now deportation absconders and others who've been ordered removed by an immigration judge, but we never actually followed up to make sure that they left so that they're here. The bottom line is immigration laws are violated on a scale that is difficult to comprehend. And what these memos do is take the first few steps necessary to sort of restore the rule of law.
Well, let's say I'm an undocumented immigrant. I've been living in the United States for 15 years. I have American-born children. I've never been arrested. I work in a restaurant. Should I be deported?
I think that's the wrong question.
Why?
The really big question is, what is the impact on American taxpayers? What is the impact on American workers from dramatically increasing the supply of workers who do restaurant work? We know that Americans who do that kind of work really struggle in the labor market, haven't received a raise for about 20 years. To allow every illegal immigrant to stay means that wages will likely stay very low at the bottom end of the labor market. So what you have to decide first is, where should our priorities as a country lie? With the 40 million Americans who live in poverty, with our own working poor, and so forth, or with people who aren't supposed to be in the country. I mean, there you sort of your fundament. And once you ask that question, then I think that the answers begin to flow from that.
Let me just finish. If you strongly
identify with the illegal immigrant, then letting them stay is clearly a benefit. If you worry a lot about America's poor or the overcrowded schools or the impact on hospitals or the impact on taxpayers, then encouraging illegal immigrants through enforcement to return home makes a great deal of sense.
So if we deported the 10, 11 million immigrants who are undocumented in the U.S., you're saying that would reduce the poverty rate in this country, that employers and companies would pay more?
Right. So it's basic economics. Right now, about half or 45% of all the high school dropouts who have a job in the United States, say that's the very bottom end of the U.S. labor market, are immigrants, that is foreign-born. About half of those are illegal. So somewhere around a fifth to a quarter of all the high school dropouts who have jobs right now in the United States are illegal immigrants. If over time we reduce that number, which is currently several million working, you would begin to see employers bidding up wages as they tried to find employees, as they tried to retain the ones that they have. Now, in a country that's increasingly worried about things like income inequality and how bad the bottom end of the U.S. labor market is, tolerating widespread illegal immigration really works against those goals. So one of the biggest beneficiaries of reducing the population of illegal immigrants in the United States would be our own working poor. Now, it's true that the illegal immigrant would be worse off, and if that's your primary concern, and that's understandable, then sending people home or encouraging them to return home may not be good policy. Also, the employers might be worse off, because by paying lower wages, it generally increases the return to capital. But if you're concerned about our poor, letting illegal immigrants stay is certainly not a good idea.
Is it important, though, to differentiate between someone who is a member of a gang and someone who runs a red light, for instance?
Yeah, absolutely. And these new memos are very clear that it's criminal aliens are definitely prioritized, followed by people who've been charged with a crime, followed by people who are those deportation absconders I mentioned, people who've abused the welfare system. There's a clear hierarchy. But what the memo also says is that if immigration authorities become aware of your illegal presence in the United States and you're subject to deportation, then they're going to move against you. In other words, being illegal in the United States means what it is, that you're illegal. Under the Obama administration, essentially, what they said was virtually all illegal immigrants were safe and they wouldn't go after them except for this small category of criminal aliens. What the Trump administration says is we're going to prioritize the criminal aliens, but being illegal is illegal, and if we come across you, we're going to make you leave, because the Trump administration is concerned about the impact on taxpayers and American workers. They're putting a much higher priority on that rather than the illegal immigrants themselves and their well-being.
Well, speaking of taxpayers, part of this memorandum, hiring more border agents, hiring more ICE agents, more judges, more detention centers, and then building a wall. How do you sell that to the American people if this is, and clearly if you add it all up, we're talking about billions and billions of dollars.
Sure, but this can all pay for itself if it reduces illegal immigration. Let me just give you a quick example.
How's
with
that
regard
work?
To the wall.
Sure.
Yeah, sure. So the National Academy of Sciences has actually developed estimates on what immigrants cost taxpayers, both all that they pay and all that they use, by education level. Now, in the case of illegals, this is not true for the immigrant population generally, but of the illegal immigrant population, they have about a 10th grade education on average. If you apply the education matrices that the national academies have come up by education, those fiscal impacts, to, say, likely border crossers, you get that their lifetime fiscal drain, the difference between what they pay in taxes and use in services, the difference is about $7.5 billion for every 100,000 we keep out. Now, since the latest research suggests that we might get about 1.7 million new illegal immigrants trying to cross our border in the next 10 years, if you just kept 10 or 15% of them out, it would cover the cost of a $15 billion border wall. If you kept half of them out, the savings to taxpayers would be about $64 billion. So enforcement over time, because illegal immigrants create such a large drain on taxpayers, can pay for itself. And I
You know what, Steve, let me just jump in here. And I don't have the numbers at my fingertips, but it doesn't seem to make any sense that you're going to find, by keeping people here who are undocumented out of the country, you're going to get billions and billions of dollars to pay for just the wall itself.
Yeah, let me go through those numbers real quick again.
Yeah, real quick, because I want to get back to my conversation with my guest here. Just 40 seconds,
sure.
If you
so
got.
If you assume that we get about 1.7 million border crossers based on DHS research in the next 10 years, and if you kept just half of them out with a border wall, given what illegal immigrants cost us based on education, the savings would be about $64 billion. Easily enough to cover a $10 or $20 billion wall. So that's at the border. For every illegal immigrant that you send home, the savings is about $75,000 in lifetime. So for every 100,000, again, that you send home, it's about $7.5 billion in savings. So if you send just a few hundred thousand home, it can pay for the extra agents. It pays for itself.
Well, Steve, we have to end on that note. Thanks for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
A different perspective. Steve Camerata, Director of Research at the Center for Immigration Studies. And I do need to give my guests a chance to respond. Let me start with you, Caitlin Berry.
Sure. So what I would like to first put on my professor hat and just say that referring to people as illegals is both grammatically and legally inaccurate and is also incredibly inflammatory and stigmatizing. So I think there could have been much better choices of language used there. In addition to this idea that immigrants are a drain on our resources is a fantasy that is created to justify the kind of racist and xenophobic policies that the speaker was pushing. As you said, I can't imagine how much money would be spent on terrorizing communities to actually try to carry out the deportation on a scale that they are referring to, how many billions of dollars that could instead be spent on jobs, on job creation programs, on investing in our education so that people have better job opportunities, on health care so that people are receiving the kind of health care that they need to survive. What we need to be talking about is divesting from the kind of militarized policing that leads to these cycles of trauma in our community and investing in programs that will benefit everyone. This idea that it's somehow immigrants are to blame for the low wages they receive is such a twisted turn of logic. I'm not even sure how to respond. Immigrants don't set the wage that they receive. As someone who works with people receiving minimum wage, I will tell you, it is, if they had a choice, they would obviously make a different decision.
Go ahead, Erica Almiron.
Well, I also want to start by saying that I'm always surprised when a clear capitalist is interested in the poor, right? And I think that some of the language that he's using about immigrants being a drain, we do a lot of work on education reform in Philadelphia and across the country, and our schools are underfunded, and they're underfunded because they are populated by black and brown children. People do not want to invest in the lives of our young people. And also, if there was a choice, a lot of our young people would finish high school. A lot of our young people would go to college. And I also think that this concept that you build a wall and somehow you're saving money, that wall, the people who are going to profit off of that are actually all of Trump's friends, right, who have built walls across the country. And also that a wall doesn't keep people who are trying to survive out. You're never addressing the root causes of migration. And so this is clearly about creating jobs that are about those 15,000 interior enforcement agents. What kind of jobs are we creating in this world? Jobs to terrorize people of color? Is that what we're thinking about moving forward? Because that's what we're doing. And so I think we need to be thinking about who these policies impact and how racist actually these policies are. And that is what we're moving towards under this administration of racist. He's a white supremacist. And so if we don't call Trump out as a white supremacist now, we're going to miss the mark of what we're up against.
Erica Guadalupe Nunez, go ahead.
So I was trying my best to try to listen to his supposedly factual evidence, but there are so many things about that were just completely incorrect right off the bat. First of all, the idea that this wall is going to stop migration, when, first of all, migration across the border is already pretty much at zero because of the unfriendly policies that Obama had. So many people are leaving the U.S. because it is not a safe and unfriendly place. And Obama did that already. He's making people leave. And it's basically already at zero. Also, the idea that immigrants don't pay taxes. That's insane. We pay so much in taxes, and we don't get a tax. We don't get anything in return. Mm-hmm. And deporting immigrants would cost this country so much money. And that I hate, first of all, I hate having to say that, but that is, again, a fact against what he said. And just the idea that immigrants are the reason for poverty in this country, that is not the case. It's not the case for why poverty exists. It's not the case for why wages are low. It's, in fact, capitalism, something that he supposedly is trying to stand up, raise up. That is what's causing poverty in this country.
Let me quickly read an email from Annika. While violence in communities is at the core of this issue, I don't think I understand the argument for keeping a violent, undocumented offender in the United States. Let me toss that to you, Caitlin. Then we've got a caller to join the conversation.
Right. So I think it's a very important question, and I think it's obviously a question that would take much longer than a few minutes to answer. But I think it is a question that is sort of at the core of what values we want to see expressed in our policies, in the way that we are treating our neighbors. If you think about the situation of someone who has been arrested, has been accused of doing something that is violent, has gone to court for that charge, a U.S. citizen would then walk out after they had finished their time, after they had done whatever it is that the court ordered, right? Return home to their community, return home to their family. Why should someone who is not a U.S. citizen be subjected to a secondary level of punishment and be forced to then be exiled from their family and not have the opportunity to rebuild their life that would be given to someone else? A lot can be said about how we treat people in our criminal system, and sure. I'm not here to say that the system is working perfectly, but I think it's important for people to remember it's not as if someone is being let go without any kinds of consequences. In fact, it's to the contrary, right? People are suffering very severe consequences. And people who are not U.S. citizens are then being subjected to this secondary level of punishment.
Let's get a comment from our comment line. This is Scott calling us.
My name is Scott Wyatt. I'm calling from Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. My comment is, I want to know who's paying for all of this. I pay taxes. I pay federal taxes. They're not paying, you know, illegal immigrants aren't paying federal taxes. No matter how compelling their moral position, their ethical position might be, I don't want to pay for this. And by the way, as I recall, the city is $2 billion in the red. So I guess we're borrowing money from China to harbor illegal immigrants and to protect them from the federal government. Explain to me who's paying for this.
Well, I think we covered this, and what I heard from all of you, and perhaps if I can toss this back to you, Caitlin Berry, as our resident lawyer here, people who are here undocumented do pay taxes.
Absolutely. Every person that I represent, every worker that I work with pays taxes, and as Erica was saying—
Even if they don't have a Social Security number?
Absolutely. And as Erica was saying, they don't then receive refunds, and they will never receive Social Security benefits. So let's also be clear about that. They are paying into a system that will directly benefit that call. And I'm not sure what he's saying, who's paying for all of this. The city is actually conserving resources by not expanding the system of mass incarceration to detain undocumented people without warrants, or not using city employee staff time and resources to carry out these kinds of actions. So we're actually saving money, and I'm unclear what the caller was referring to.
Mm-hmm. Well, we are almost out of time. Can I give the two Ericas a chance? Erica Almiron, just final thoughts, 15 seconds, if you don't mind.
Sure. I think that we have to organize. I think that there is a movement that is brewing. It is, and I think that the common enemy goes beyond Trump. It goes that we're in a moment right now where I think white supremacy is in control of this government, and we need to build together to tear it down.
Erica Guadalupe Nunez, final thoughts.
Just
12
like,
seconds.
Yeah, just like Erica said, I think now it's time to resist. It's time to resist white supremacy in all of its forms. It's time to resist untrue facts that threaten our community and make it easier for us to be dehumanized and deported. And it's across the board, uniting as a community to fight these racist, deep white supremacist people. Yeah.
Well, my thanks to all three of you for joining us today
Thank you, Radio Times.
And Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times. The program is produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Trinae Nuri. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Thank you so much for joining us.